For example, Lieutenant Colonel Whitney Stone, commander of the Boston Ordnance District, tells us that 43 ordnance depots in the United States have been geared to General Eisenhower's invasion day plans. These depots are pouring a stream of guns, ammunition, vehicles, and spare parts into strategically located distribution plants in the United States. The Ordnance Department, says General Stone, is supplying 2,300 separate major combat items and 350,000 kinds of spare parts, parts needed to keep the machines of war in repair. The job of storing all this, of knowing where each item is, and of being ready to furnish battle equipment and replacement parts to some 70-odd different theaters of operations in all parts of the world is a gigantic operation in itself. But more important is the fact that we have the supplies for war, the supplies we did not have in 1941, and they are moving out to war in unbelievable volume and streaming across the channel. And for all theaters of operation, the most important of which at the moment, of course, is General Eisenhower's theater, Army Ordnance has more warehouse storage space than all the civilian warehouses in the country combined. They ship war out of these warehouses at the rate of $1 billion worth a month, $1 billion worth of anti-Axis fireworks. And how does this $1 billion worth of fireworks, together with everything else the Army needs, get to a war theater? That's the job of transport. There are all kinds of transport, air, motor, railway, but primarily there is ocean transport, ships, moving from the United States to Great Britain under convoy day and night. The supplies of war mesh into position from all of the United Nations. And now what happens in this meshing job? That's where the services of supply step into the picture, the Armed Service Forces. They're called the Army Service Forces now. And well over half our men are engaged in supply, from food to ammunition, communication, and medical attention, and so on. But transport is the big job. Our transportation service in Britain has been merged with the British transport services so that there's no disputing the right of way, nor is there any alibying, buck-passing from one service to the other, any failure to keep invasion schedules. Nevertheless, the American Military Transportation Service has kept its own identity in Britain, and once supplies are run through the British transport system and put back into the hands of our forces somewhere in Britain, our services take hold again. Because of this double Anglo-American load, however, the transportation system of Britain has been running an average of 1.25 billion tons of freight every day in preparation for invasion. The canal system of the British Isles, a system perhaps you never heard about, is moving 1 million tons of invasion per month. Also backing up invasion, speeding it along, there's a fleet of 14,000 long-distance trucks, and the British railway system is running about 2,000 extra trains a week, special trains for troops and other invasion traffic. That's why the British government the other day appealed to the people not to make any journey of any kind that they could possibly delay. And once the trains have deposited the troops in the port, the whole business has to be reloaded into ships and boats. That takes more complicated planning than mere railway movement. Each ship is blueprinted, that is, loaded on paper first, so that all the space will be used, so that the weight will be evenly distributed, and so the right packages are put in the right places. Communications is another big factor in invasion. Communications hold an army together, repair its wounds. That is, if a whole unit is shot away, it's up to communications to patch up the gap and tie the main members together again. In the British Isles, the United States Army runs a full-time teleprinter system. And for the beachhead operation, short-range radio and telephone equipment, from walkie-talkies up to truck outfits, are all ready for the job, so the forward units can talk back to the shore units in more ways than one. That's why you've been able to get so many dramatic reports from NBC reporters on the scene within a very few hours of actual invasion attack. Our military railway units in Great Britain have whole railway systems, collapsible boxcars and all, ready to run on the rails of Europe. But that's getting ahead of our story. That's part of stages 6 and 7 of invasion. We're now in stage 5, the toughest stage of them all, the job of taking that first 1,000 yards of beachhead. In another supply shed in Britain, I have seen a complete motor assembly line, just like the assembly lines in Detroit or Pontiac, Michigan. It's a repair depot where broken trucks and all kinds of motor vehicles, which are worn out, can be taken apart and rebuilt and sent right back into the battle again. We have also set up in Britain an air transport wing to ferry all kinds of planes to Europe and see that they're in fighting trim when they get there. These planes also carry strategic parts and material for the Army Service Forces, things needed at the drop of a hat. And all of this is a part of the business of getting a soldier ashore in a hostile area and advancing him that first 1,000 yards. Now, about the actual combat. As time goes by, hours, days, and weeks, The whole strategy and tactics of getting ashore on continental Europe will be revealed. At the moment, we know part of the story, that the air forces are blasting the daylights out of German positions. The airmen hope to prevent the enemy from hindering, from the air, our initial attack. There'll be plenty of transporting of troops by air to critical points, too, as the initial struggle gets underway. But the naval armada, the escorting ships, and the actual vessels of the invading forces all sail to a rendezvous in these invasion attacks. At that point, ships designated for the dash ashore are herded together like sheep under the guns of a special naval task force, all waiting for the 0 hour they've set. At that moment, they steam shoreward to assault the particular strip of beach they've been told to take. And in the very first ships are the Army's combat teams. They've been training for more than 2 years for this moment. The youngest, most athletic of our soldiers and Britons are in this small wave. They're all-purpose men. They're a small duplicate of a huge army, skilled in hand-to-hand combat like the commandos, only with more specialized training, perhaps. We cannot tell you today just what these teams do, how they're operating to gain a toehold, but all the lessons learned through the spilling of blood at Salerno, Dieppe, Tarawa, are in this app, seared in the minds of these men. They're the cream of the crop. They're determined and fearless. And before they landed, they knew they would set foot on beaches strongly fortified with artillery, mines, pillboxes, tank traps, and other barriers still more horrible. And each man, as he went ashore last night, had the equivalent of this order from his general. You have a clear-cut and limited objective. You will get through heavily fortified beaches. You will take the first 1,000 yards. And remember, there has never in all history been such a landing as the one you're participating in today. What you do will be written indelibly on the pages of history. For everything that has been done in America and Britain has been preparation for this hour, this moment. The production lines were set in motion for this. The planes have paved the way for this. The workers have worked long hours in factories for this. The Battle of the Atlantic was won for this. The whole vast organization of war has been organized, geared to this. You, soldier, are to take the first 1,000 yards.
You have just heard Morgan Beatty speaking from Washington. Now NBC continues its coverage of the invasion as we return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
As part of the NBC's network coverage of the invasion, we bring you now more late news from the NBC newsroom in New York.
This is Clyde Cattell speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York and bringing you a brief summary of the news to date. And we start with a bulletin. Prime Minister Churchill told the House of Commons today that an immense Allied armada of 4,000 ships with several thousand smaller craft had carried Allied forces across the Channel for the invasion of Europe. And here's more on Mr. Churchill's statement. Mass Allied airborne landings have been successfully effected behind the enemy lines in France, Prime Minister Winston Churchill announced in the House of Commons today. Landings on the beaches are proceeding at various points, he said. Well, D-Day is here. Allied armies that landed on the coast of northern France early this morning are already moving inland, beginning their march toward Berlin and the heart of Hitler's Europe. There has as yet been no official announcement as to where the landings were made. But German reports say they were carried out from Le Havre to Cherbourg, along the north coast of Normandy and the south side of the Bay of the Sands. It's just been announced that U.S. battleships are supporting the Allied landings, that our Coast Guard units are also taking part in the operations. And American Marines are in the fighting, too, manning secondary guns aboard the big ships. The land push was started by American, British, and Canadian forces, who received their invasion orders directly from General Eisenhower, the Supreme Allied Commander. The landing was announced at 3:32 o'clock this morning, when NBC listeners heard the official communique. And then followed the first eyewitness account of the landings, a broadcast by NBC's Wright Bryant. The landing operations were in direct command of General Sir Bernard Montgomery. The Nazis say 6 Allied heavy warships and 20 destroyers joined in the invasion effort. According to the Nazi claims, forces of the German Navy took on the Allied landing craft. Meanwhile, the War Department in Washington says American troops have knocked out pillboxes and other fortifications along the Atlantic Wall. The War Department reports that these troops, making the first attack on the western side of Fortress Europe, are specially trained and hand-picked units. They put into practice tactics which were perfected in North Africa, Sicily, and Italy. Overhead, as the Allied troops go forward, Allied planes are smashing at the enemy. The headquarters of the European Theater of Operations says Allied planes are, and we quote, hitting any target that has a bearing on the strength of the armies at the front. The report says that no target is too small. Flyers of the 9th United States Air Force are flying more fighter-bomber missions with more aircraft than any Air Force in history. Before the Allies officially announced the invasion, the Allied High Command told the French people a new phase in the air war had begun. The broadcast did not elaborate, but a broadcast to the Dutch told the people of Holland to evacuate their coastline at once to a depth of 21.5 miles. However, there are no reports on landings in Holland. On the Italian war front, Fifth Army troops are driving ahead this morning, still pushing northward against weakening German resistance. Our men have driven 5 miles beyond the Tiber River, and other Allied units are still going over that stream at several other places. The Nazis have apparently not left even rear guard forces behind as they retreat toward the Po River. The fall of the Italian capital, the eternal city of Rome, was memorialized last night in that address by President Roosevelt. And his broadcast was perfectly timed with the invasion drive of our armies into northern France. And of the capture of Rome, the president said, "That's one up and two to go." He referred, of course, to the fact that Allied armies still have Berlin and Tokyo to conquer. But the president warned against overconfidence, pointing out that final victory still lies some distance ahead of us. But Mr. Roosevelt declared that distance will be covered, that ultimate triumph will be ours. On the eastern front, land action is still on a relatively quiet scale. But the Russians are expected to strike out now to renew their drive toward the west, toward Berlin. There's been every sign of late that the Red Army was holding its divisions back, waiting for the opening of the second front in Europe. But that second front now opened, new large-scale offensive action is expected from the Russians. The latest word we have from Moscow, though, gives no indication that such a renewed offense has yet begun. The Germans continue to attack around the Romanian city of Iasi, and the Russians continue to beat them back, taking a heavy toll of enemy soldiers and equipment. In the Southwest Pacific, our latest attacks have taken another chunk out of the Japanese fleet. In operations north of Dutch New Guinea, our airmen sank one Jap destroyer and left another sinking. Other raids were carried out over the enemy base of Kruk. Our progress is slow but steady in the land campaign for the airdromes on Biak Island in the Skooten Group. Washington's attention will be divided today between the new drive in Europe and plans for a new investigation of the Jap attack on Pearl Harbor. A congressional investigation into that enemy sneak action has been proposed by Senators Ferguson and Chandler. It would be separate from any other inquiries made by the Army or Navy. The Senators passed a resolution urging the two services to make their own studies so that the facts may be recorded for any future trials of Admiral Kimmel and Major General Short, the Navy and Army commanders at Pearl Harbor at the time of the attack. Incidentally, Washington has two members of the Clark family making news this morning. While General Clark is leading his 5th Army north of Rome in Italy, Mrs. Clark is preparing to aid in the 5th War Loan Drive. She said in a United Press interview that she was excited and very humble over the news of the fall of Rome. But to do her part in the war effort, Mrs. Clark will leave in a few days to open war loan campaigns in the New England sections of the country. And that's the news up to now. This is Clyde Cattell speaking from the NBC newsroom in New York, and turning you now over to Robert St. John.
At 37 minutes past midnight this morning, there were only two or three men sitting around the NBC newsroom. It had been a busy news day, but around midnight, things had quieted down. News editor Buck Prince and several men of his staff were having coffee and donuts. And then, at 12:37, the bells on one of our automatic news machines began to ring. Coffee and donuts were forgotten because bells mean a bulletin, and any bulletin might be the bulletin we were all waiting for, the bulletin announcing the invasion of Western Europe. But this looked like an innocent, unimportant bulletin at first. It was just some Nazi claim. But wait, it might be the tip-off on the big story. It told of a broadcast by the German Transocean Agency, a broadcast claiming that the Allied invasion had begun. The NBC network at that moment was carrying a dance band from Hollywood. The music was suddenly stopped. An announcer read the German claim. He was careful to state that this might be a phony. After all, it was from Berlin, and you can't trust Berlin. But on the other hand, it might be true. And so NBC's D-Day plan was quickly put into effect. Telephone operators got commentators and news writers and engineers and announcers on the telephone, and they came streaming in from all corners of New York and its suburbs. They rushed in by taxi cab, by subway, by bus. one engineer couldn't find anything faster than a milk truck to bring him in. Now more and more German claims were pouring in over our NBC news machines. But still, silence from London and Washington. But in both places, NBC men were in action. In Washington, they were rushing out to the Pentagon building, the War Department's headquarters. In London, of course, the boys over there knew what was happening. Three or four NBC men were out on the operation. The rest of them in our London office were standing by, waiting for the signal which would allow them to broadcast the greatest story of the century to a waiting world. I can tell you it was a nervous, jittery 3 or 4 hours here in the NBC newsroom while we waited to find out, is it true? Is it false? Is it the real thing? Or is it just another German claim, a German fishing expedition? 3 hours while we prated back and forth to these NBC microphones, bringing you bulletin after bulletin from Paris, from Berlin, from Vichy. Bulletins which we didn't know whether they were true or not. Bulletins which claimed that this had happened and that had happened, that planes were dropping paratroopers over Europe, that France had been invaded. But still, we didn't know. We passed them on to you for 3 solid hours there, warning each time this might be true, but it might be only Nazi propaganda. Calais Radio at 1:56 said, "This is D-Day." We passed that on to you. A little later, the DNB German agency said that Le Havre was being violently bombarded and that German naval craft were fighting Allied landing craft off the shore. We passed that on to you. We still didn't know. 2:31 a.m. And then we began to get a feeling that it was really the thing. A spokesman for General Eisenhower made a broadcast from London to the people of occupied Europe, a broadcast in which he warned them that a new phase of the Allied air offensive has begun. That's all he said. He said nothing about invasion. And he ordered them to move 22 miles inland. He warned them to stay away from roads, to stay away from bridges. And then, at 3:29, Berlin Radio said that paratroop landings were being made on the Normandy Peninsula. And then, just before 3:30, a message came to us here in the NBC newsroom from London, telling us to stand by for a broadcast at 3:32 a.m. We knew what that meant. We knew then, finally, at last, after 3 solid hours of worrying, we knew at last that it was really happening. And then, at 3:32, it hit. It hit the air. We sent you over the NBC network and all the affiliated stations across the country. All of them were standing by on a 24-hour schedule. We sent you the flash from Eisenhower's headquarters that Allied armies had begun to land on the coast of France. From then on, the news poured in, bits of news which gradually, from which we were gradually able to build up the picture. One bulletin, for example, told us that British General Sir Bernard Montgomery was in charge of the American, British, and Canadian troops who were making the assault. Well, if you have been up with us during the early hours of the morning, you know how we covered the story. H.V. Kaltenborn came rushing in and gave you one of his unusual, his amazing ad-lib comments on what it all meant. We brought you Louis Lochner from Hollywood. We brought you Morgan Beatty and Richard Harkness from Washington. Here from New York, Don Goddard and Clyde Cattell filled in many of the details. And then abroad, over there in London, those men who had been waiting so long for the chance to get the air. David Anderson, one of our NBC war correspondents, came back to the NBC studios in London after having been out with the British forces, and he gave you an eyewitness account of what he'd seen. And then Wright Bryan, from Atlanta, Georgia, an NBC war correspondent, the first man to come back to make an eyewitness broadcast. He was with the paratroopers. And then there was Ed Hawker, who had been with the Air Force. And then there was John W. Vandercook, who was in the NBC studio in London. And then down in Washington, NBC announcer Holly Wright made an unusual broadcast from the Pentagon building. It was the first broadcast of D-Day made over any network. It was made over NBC by NBC's announcer Holly Wright, who gave us a color picture of what was happening in the War Department's headquarters. And then from Washington, we also heard the French minister telling in his dramatic, broken English what all this meant to France. And it's still going on. Right outside the door of this glassed-in studio, there are 8 or 10 news machines pouring in bulletin after bulletin after bulletin. Germany claims that she's doing this. Germany claims that she's wiped out so many regiments of American soldiers, sunk so many ships. But now we don't have to pay any attention to Berlin, because now the official, authentic story of the invasion of Western Europe is coming to us from Allied headquarters. The news that has come to us today from our Allied commanders in the European theater of operations is the news which all America, all the world, has long anticipated. It's the news which millions of Allied troops have been trained so long to produce. Through the long months and years of work, these millions of men have been pointing toward this very day of reckoning. Through the same long months, in all NBC news broadcasts, our first thought has been to bring to the nation, with accuracy and with speed, the deeds of our fighting men and the deeds of our allies. We have not overestimated the strength and the resourcefulness of our enemies. Neither have we underestimated the power and vigor and the ability in combat of our own American fighting men. In our own small way, we've made preparations for continuing to cover this biggest war news story of all with accuracy and with speed. While American fighting men have been training in camps and in combat here and abroad, our NBC reporters have gone with them. NBC's radio reporters have seen frontline action. They've landed with troops in beach assaults. They've been wounded. They've been hospitalized with disease. And they've recovered and gone back into action, just as our troops have done. NBC reporters wear the uniform of the United States Army, and they are sworn to merit the privilege of wearing it. No NBC man has failed to accept his assignment, nor has he failed to complete the assignment. NBC's staff of radio newsmen is now engaged in covering this newest and greatest assignment of all. At NBC, we have selected able and experienced reporters, and we've sent them abroad. The Army, the Air Corps, and the Navy have assigned them their places with the invading forces. We wish them Godspeed and good fortune wherever they may be. On this network of 143 stations of the National Broadcasting Company, we are now standing by for additional developments, which we will pass on to you minute by minute and hour by hour as they happen. News of the invasion will take precedence over all network programs in order that the nation may be informed immediately of action on all fronts. Commanding officers of all the armed forces have given instructions that the American public be informed quickly of all invasion developments. We of NBC are pledged to perform our duty in bringing you this news. On this side of the Atlantic, at our newsrooms in New York, in Washington, across the country, in all affiliated stations of the NBC network, our feelings today are no different than the feelings of every American. We await the outcome. We pray for the triumph of our cause. We maintain our confidence in that ultimate triumph.
You've just heard Robert St. John, NBC commentator, speaking from New York. And now we present Alex Dreyer, the last American reporter to leave Germany before the war. We take you now to Chicago and Alex Dreyer.
This NBC reporter was stationed in the Nazi Reich through 1940 and 41, until some 14 hours before Pearl Harbor. I had gone behind the German armies as they swept through Belgium, Holland, and France, and I was on the French Channel coast when the Luftwaffe initiated the long, enduring blitz of London. Never had I seen such confidence, such cockiness, such surety of purpose, as was exemplified in the expressions of those Nazi pilots. There was never a doubt in the minds of those fanatical Germans that this was the beginning of the great Nazi empire, which Hitler had preached to them about so often. Back in Berlin, German civilians, tired of the war even at that stage, thought that the Blitz in Britain might bring the war's termination. When I left Germany on the 6th of December in 41, the retreats in Russia had just begun. The Nazis were just beginning to learn the bitter taste inherent in that butter of butters, butter for cannon. What is now happening in Western Europe is what the German civilian, contrary to the Nazi propagandists, has always expected ever since the Battle of Britain was won by the RAF. The Nazi can no more escape defeat than he can escape history. And no one is more aware of that axiom than is the average German. Poised against the Allied invading forces in Western Europe are some 800,000 to 900,000 Nazis positioned in the Low Countries and France. And in France proper, there are probably no more than 600,000 Nazis. The general area selected by the Allied command as the initial point of landing in the liberation of Europe lies some 100 miles from England. This is the Normandy coast, with rather fair landing places for our shallow draft landing barges. If the Le Havre area is now receiving the brunt of the Allied attacking force, it is appropriate for reasons other than those of general military strategy. This is the port where the British, in their hurried flight from France, left enough stores behind to feed a BEF for 5 years on the soil of Western Europe. I was at that port not long after the British had left it. I saw foodstuffs of all description. There was everything from Dole Hawaiian pineapple to California packing tomatoes. In the British officer's mess, dishes were still on the table, half filled with food, underscoring the hurried departure of the ill-equipped English. Now light armies are hitting back and in the same area. The Le Havre area is where I saw the Nazis assembling barges and boats of all description for an invasion of their own. At a Nazi officer's party in the summer of 1940, along that strip of France, a Nazi major boasted that the jewel, which was England, would be Hitler's inside of 10 weeks. That was when the famous Tote organization was constructing airfields so fast in France that even Goering at one time did not know the exact number of fields which were at his disposal. Planes of every type were poured into France and stationed at strategic points all along the coast. Back in Berlin, we foreign correspondents stationed in the Reich capital were told that we would soon be crossing the Channel as guests of the Nazi Reich in the invasion of another country. Now against the area from which the Nazis had hoped to launch their invasion, Eisenhower's forces of liberation are directing their initial weight. While the cliffs on the West Normandy coast are precipitous, the landing places are almost ideal. The distance between Abbeville and Le Havre is about 100 miles. This means that the Allies may be using the rivers, Seine and Somme, which enclose that area, as natural defenses for their flanks as they press inward. The first German defense lines have already been cracked, and the men in those lines are the so-called do-or-die Nazis. And if we can judge by the initial reports, it would seem that a number of them have already died. In no other way could we have penetrated so deeply, so quickly, and maintained our position. It was at the Somme estuary near Abbeville that the Germans in May of 1940 first broke through to the English Channel,
splitting the Allied armies in two. The break was followed by the surrender of Belgium, then the catastrophe at Dunkirk, and then the capitulation of France. The Allied capture of Le Havre would give the Allies one of the best harbors along the coast of France, and its support the Allies will need to furnish the necessary military blood, which is men and machine, necessary for the prosecution of the drive. Of all the ports held by the Nazis along the coast, Le Havre is the closest to Paris, only about 100 miles distant. Obviously, the Allied objective is military as well as psychological. With the fall of Rome as signified for the Italian campaign, the fall of Paris would signify on an even broader scale in the campaign now underway in the west of Hitler's fortress. And now, we return you to the NBC newsroom in New York.